We're going to talk this morning about why do the innocent suffer? Why do the innocent suffer? I was talking recently with a fellow who had been through Iran, India, Nepal, and a number of countries in the East, Israel, and he said that the one question that people ask the most in many, many different forms is, why do the innocent suffer? Why is there the presence of evil and pain and suffering in the world when God is a God of love? He wanted to know that. And so he said, in many, many different ways, people ask the same question, and I've heard it many, many times too. They ask it in many different ways, many different vocabulary levels, coming from many different backgrounds, but they all ask basically the same question. And that is, why do innocent people suffer? Why are children born deformed? Why are people killed in earthquakes and tornadoes and things like that? Why do people become diseased? Why did my father and mother die in a car accident when I was 4 years old and I had to be raised without them? They ask the question in many different ways, many different vocabulary levels. A 2.5-year-old asked it one time when she heard about the children of Israel crossing the Red Sea, and she heard about the Egyptians and how the Egyptians were all drowned in the sea. Now, this wasn't exactly why did the innocent suffer, but why? Why pain? Why evil in the world if God is a God of love? And after she heard about the crossing of the Red Sea, she said, where was Jesus all this time? Didn't Jesus love the Egyptians too? So she was asking the same question. Now, there are answers for that, but of course, when you're limited to the vocabulary of a 2.5-year-old, you got a bit of a problem. Precocious 2.5-year-old, by the way. The problem itself, in any specific case, there are no easy answers. And you need to understand that from the beginning. I'll repeat this at the end. There are no easy answers to the question, why do the innocent suffer? There are some principles that apply to the question that many of us need to start working on in our minds and thinking about. There are principles that apply, but at the same time, for any specific case of why an innocent person is suffering, it's very difficult to tell for that particular person all of the causes that are involved. We may not have the information that's necessary to be able to tell someone why they're suffering. Even after you intercede, you may not have the information that's necessary to know why you, as an innocent person, may be suffering or someone else. But there are principles that are involved that are very important, things that will secure in our minds the justice of God, even though we or someone else may be suffering as an innocent person. And that is really the important point. That not that the person understands why they are suffering, but that they understand that it is not coming from God. Okay? Now that's talking about an innocent person. Guilt, we're not talking mostly during this about guilty people suffering. The Bible says that when we are guilty, when we sin, we deserve to be judged, and God will do things to people and cause them to suffer if they're guilty. But then that's not really a problem for us because we know then that we deserve it. You understand? You got that? Right? So in other words, take for instance the issue of Sodom and Gomorrah. It is not a question for us why the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, the adults of Sodom and Gomorrah, were killed because they were wicked. God explains that very clearly. The question is, what about the children in Sodom and Gomorrah? It's not a question of why did God kill the Canaanites, because the Canaanites were so wicked. It was judgment upon them. But the question is, what about the children of the Canaanites? Right? Why couldn't they be raised as Jews? Why couldn't the people adopt them and raise them as Jews? There are answers to that. You need to study it, find out, so you can answer people's questions. Okay? God was just in killing man, woman, and child. You know how? Why? Well, you need to study it then, find out. Okay? So there are no easy answers to the question of why did the innocent suffer. And it's a very important question. You need to be really sensitive to a person who asks the question, why do the innocent suffer? And listen for that question. You need to listen and say, is this a question about the presence of evil and pain in the world in the light of a good God? That the Bible says there's a good God. You need to listen very carefully because it's asked many times, many ways, very basic question. And if you are not sensitive to the person, you basically insult their personhood. Because any person who's sensitive at all to what's going on in the world must ask the question, why do innocent people suffer? It's just not fair. Okay? And it's true, not fair, and God thinks it's not fair too. But we need to see how that works and why God at times does not step in and do things. Okay? So we need to be sensitive to those that are asking. If you communicate to somebody that they don't have the right to ask or tell them not to ask, you're insulting their personhood. Every human being has the right to ask the question, why do the innocent suffer? So anytime you hear it, take it very seriously. Take it very seriously. Anytime a person asks me a question, I take the question seriously, even if I know that they're being dishonest and they're trying to keep from serving Jesus by asking these intellectual questions. Because the question that they're asking is an important question and deserves a valid answer, even if they're using it the wrong way. So what we should do is give them a serious answer to the serious question that they're asking, and then afterwards, when they've got an answer, say, however, I feel that you were simply using that as a smokescreen to try to keep from serving Jesus. Okay? I don't think you asked the question in an honest fashion, but I gave you a serious answer because it's a serious question. You get the difference? See? One guy came to a leader of a Christian youth movement. Okay? Came to him and said, I don't know if I can really tell if I exist. Okay? And this leader, who knew the ways of God, said to him, this leader said to him, I think you're simply being dishonest. And what you need to do is just give your life over to Jesus and stop asking silly questions like that. And that person eventually, of course, the way I found out about it, the person eventually ended up with me and for counseling. And the person's question was a really valid question, because living as a humanist and existentialist, he did not know whether or not he really existed. He thought about it a lot. He wanted to have a basis for why he should assume that he actually exists. Okay? So it was a question about his identity. So we went through that, and when he had an answer to that question, he wasn't really facing problems with giving his life to Jesus. It was a real valid question that he had. So we have to be careful when somebody asks a question to take the question seriously, even though later we may have to rebuke them and tell them that I think that was a dishonest question. You were asking it in a dishonest way. But it was a good question and a serious question. Okay? So you never know. Don't just jump on somebody. You know why I think some people tell others that you're just trying to hide from Jesus? Because they can't answer the question. And they're too proud to say, I'm sorry, but I can't answer that question. I have to study some more. I don't know enough about it. Maybe there's somebody else who can help you. And they're too proud to admit that they don't know, and so they accuse the other person of being dishonest. And who's the one who's really being dishonest? I think that happens sometimes. And we need to be careful that we're honest. And if we don't know, just say, well, I don't know. Let me study for 6 months and I'll give you an answer. Mm-hmm. Why don't you come study with me and maybe we'll find out something. Okay. Now the Bible faces the question of why do the innocent suffer head on. It does not try to get around it. And of course, one of the portions of Scripture completely dedicated to it is the book of Job, which we will talk about Job later. But we're going to read right now in Job chapter 9 some of the questions that Job had about God and his justice. It is interesting that at the end of the book of Job, God says to the friends of Job, they were friends by the way, says to the friends of Job, you have not spoken rightly of me as my servant Job has spoken. And you look at the statements that he made and the questions that he had about God, and it's pretty difficult when you look at those questions to think that he was speaking correctly the whole time. But evidently, God will allow really serious emotional questions as long as the heart attitude is right. It says he never spoke anything that was unseemly about God. See? He had lots of questions. I don't know why this is happening to me. I don't know of anything in my life that should bring this on. I don't know why this is coming to me. See? And he asked lots of questions. Is this God that's doing this to me? Because that's what his comforters were saying. But they were saying he was sinful. See? And at the end of the book, God says that he's spoken rightly of him with his mouth. And you go, really? Job was right with his mouth all the way through? Yeah, but that's what God said. See? And if we come along and say there was something wrong with Job, we call God a liar. And I've heard that kind of teaching on the book of Job, that really Job was in fear, or Job was in unbelief, or Job was in da-da-da-da-da-da, and they name all these things that were problems with Job, right? The whole point of the book of Job is that the comforters were wrong. They were wrong. They were saying he was sinful. See? And God at the end of the book says, you have not spoken rightly of me as my servant Job has spoken. And at the beginning of the book, he says that Job, God says that Job was perfect and upright and turning away from evil. God said that about Job, not a man. Job didn't say that about himself. God said it. And yet you'll hear teaching that at the end of the teaching, when you've gone all the way through the book of Job, what they basically said was Job was guilty of something, and that was why he was suffering. And if he'd only had a little more faith, or had a little less fear, then he wouldn't have gone through that. And so what happened? The whole point of the book of Job is completely eliminated. The point of the book of Job is truly innocent people can truly suffer. And it's not God's fault. Okay, let's read in Job 9 some of these statements that he makes. You'll see some of the philosophies that we've been talking about revealed in his statement. For though I were right, For though I were right, I could not answer. I would have to implore the mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I could not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he bruises me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not allow me to get my breath, but saturates me with bitterness. If it is a matter of power, behold, he is the strong one. And if it is a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am righteous, my mouth will condemn me. Though I am guiltless, he will declare me guilty. I am guiltless. I do not take notice of myself. One. I am guiltless. I do not take notice of myself. Notice the temptation towards the bad self-image when you're suffering. I despise my life. If somebody said that to me in a counseling session, I would ask them if they were planning to commit suicide. It is all one. I would ask them if they're involved in Eastern religion. Therefore, I say, he destroys the guiltless and the wicked. If the scourge kills suddenly, he mocks the despair of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, then who is it? Now, very serious questions, and you read these kinds of things, and at the end of the book you go, he never said anything wrong about God with his mouth. Interesting. Evidently, you can ask really serious, emotional, gut-level questions of God, and as long as your heart attitude is right, God is not going to knock you down or say that you're wrong for asking those questions. See? Some people are very afraid to ask questions of God. God's not afraid of a question. He's not afraid to handle our emotions and the problems in our life. You know, it's not going to threaten him any. Okay, he wants to give us answers. Okay, so the Bible faces the question head on. It does not hide from it. The way the question is usually stated, and this is a humanist form of question, the way the question is usually stated goes something like this. Either God is omnipotent, that is all-powerful, either God is omnipotent and he's not loving because he doesn't stop suffering. In other words, he has the power to do so, but he doesn't want to do it for some reason. He's some kind of an ogre. Either God is omnipotent and not loving, or God is loving, but he's too weak to stop suffering. Either God is omnipotent and not loving, or God is loving, but he's too weak. Okay? Now, that kind of argument involves, if you think about it, bad definitions of the word God, love, and omnipotent. And also, the word love changes its definition, its meaning, from one sentence to the next. And that in philosophy is called equivocation. So it's bad reasoning, but that's usually the way the question is asked. They say God is either too weak to stop suffering, or he's simply not loving, even though he's powerful enough to stop it. Now that is the way, how many of you have seen The Hiding Place? The movie, The Hiding Place. Okay, or read the book. That is the way the question was asked to Corrie ten Boom and her sister when they were in the concentration camp. Remember when they were sitting around and the woman was sitting on the top bunk and she says, well, if God is all-powerful, then he should stop it if he's loving. And that means then that he's either weak or he's not powerful enough to stop it. Now, they had to be true to history and give the answer that God gave them to give at that time. And they gave the answer according to the knowledge that they had at that time, which I believe personally did not really philosophically answer the question. But they had to be honest to history and say what kind of answer they gave at that time, as far as they could remember. But I believe that the answer that they gave did not really answer the question. The answer that they gave was that there's nothing that we go through that God hasn't already gone through, which is true, which means that God can feel the same kinds of things that we're going through, even if we're innocent people who are suffering. But it doesn't answer the question as to why there can be that suffering, even though God is a God of love. It doesn't answer the question. It's an important issue that God has suffered. He's the most innocent person in the universe and suffers the most. Right? He's innocent. He's never done anything wrong that he should suffer. And yet he's rejected and suffers infinite grief over the sin of man. And so he's the most innocent. He suffers the most. So he's gone through. He goes through what we go through as innocent parties. But that does not answer the question for the purpose of the person's mind. Okay? So we want to look at some inadequate answers to the question. Inadequate answers to the question of why do the innocent suffer? Every philosophy in the world will be faced with the question, why do the innocent suffer? And every philosophy in the world will have to give some kind of an answer to that. And so there are many philosophies that try to give answers, and we want to look at a few of those and the answers that they try to give and see how they are basically insufficient answers. Got that? Okay. First is the humanistic answer. Now remember, the humanist is usually not trying to give his own ideas because he doesn't believe in God. He is usually making a response to the Christian idea that God is a God of love and yet there is suffering in the world. The humanist, starting from his own presupposition, doesn't even really have to ask the question because he says, why do innocent people suffer? Oh, that's the way the world is. That's part of the process of natural selection or evolution or the process of chance or whatever in the world. He does not try to ask the question in reference to God because there isn't any God in his system. Okay? So he's usually asking the question because of the way Christians have presented that to him. Okay? So they say this. They're responding to the idea that God is the creator or God is the source of all things. And they say, if God is the source of all things, then God is responsible or he's the cause. He's responsible for the existence of things, and therefore he's basically the cause of things. And then they prefer to deny the reality of God because they wouldn't want a God like that. If God is the cause of all things, then God must also be the cause of suffering and pain and disease and evil in the world. And if God is the author of all those things, then we don't want to know a God like that. And I agree with the humanists. If God were the cause of all suffering and pain and disease and evil in the world, I would not want to know a God like that either. And so they deny the reality of God. They're usually just asking the question as a response to what they've heard from Christians, however. Now, the humanist has a right to ask the question as a human being. Every human being has a right to ask the question. As a humanist, however, the humanist does not have the right to ask the question, why do the innocent suffer? Can you think of why? No. Close. It's an absolute statement. It deals with what? Yeah. Deals with opposites. Deals with morality. It says that there is guilty and innocent, and within the humanist framework, there is no such thing. You cannot establish guilt and innocence when you have no moral absolute. And so the humanist, not being able to establish moral absolute, has to borrow Christian words to ask the question, why do the innocent suffer? Okay? So they have a right as a human being to ask the question, but as a humanist, they have to borrow our words, our ideas, and our standards to be able to say, why do the innocent suffer? So as a humanist, they do not have the right to ask the question. That's like the communists who say, one class should not oppress another class. Excuse me, but would you define the word should within your system? What do you mean by should? If you believe in materialism and that man has evolved as an animal and there's no difference really between man and animals, and there is no God, who's going to say should and should not? When you say one class should not oppress another class, you have to borrow my Christian terms, my absolutes, my ideas, to be able to say one class should not oppress another class. That's like saying the mouse should not, and the cat should not eat the mouse. Okay? Who can say should and should not with a cat eating a mouse, catching a mouse? You can't say something like that. So when you say one class should not oppress another class, the communist doesn't have a right to say that. Okay? Because they're using terms and ideas that do not fit within their system. I presented that to an avowed communist one time. I didn't realize he was going to East Germany to work in a youth labor camp the next day. This is in Amsterdam. And I talked with him for hours. Carol and I did together. And I presented that to him. How can you say should and should not? And he could not come up with a standard of moral absolutes within the communist system. He couldn't do it. I sat him down with a piece of paper and a pen and said, here, I need to go to the toilet. You try to figure out whether or not you can establish moral absolutes on the basis of communism. And he couldn't. And so he was honest, though, and he said, I can't give you an answer to the questions that you're asking on the basis of communism. So it appears to me that communism is an insufficient philosophy for running my life. So we've got to go on. That was after 3 hours, and I was a bit tired. But we went on. And I was glad I did, because the next day he left for East Germany. I didn't know he was going to do that. Okay, so that's the first inadequate answer, the humanist answer. They deny, the answer is to deny the reality of God. But that's not a sufficient answer, okay? In the light of the evidence for God in the world, and that Christians are asking, or Christians are presenting the information to them. Second thing is the Buddhist answer. Now, of all the non-Christian philosophies, I think the Buddhist answer comes closest to the true answer. I think the Buddhist answer comes closest to the true answer, but it's a little bit off in its beginning, and it ends up being a whole lot off by the end. That's the problem. Okay? Is that water? Okay. The Buddhist answer goes like this. Suffering comes from desire. Suffering comes from desire. Now, that's very close to the Christian idea of suffering, the biblical idea. Very simply put, the biblical idea is suffering comes from the misuse of desire. You see? Which constitutes selfishness. But, see, desire in itself is not wrong, but the misuse of desire is. It's not wrong to have desire for food, but it's wrong to misuse it. It's not wrong to have a desire for sleep, but it's wrong to misuse it. It's not wrong to have a desire for friendship or companionship, but it's wrong to misuse it. Okay? And God is the one who determines what proper use is. Okay, so what the Buddhists propose then is because suffering comes from desire, that you need to deny desire. You need to learn to live without any ambition. Learn to live without desire. Of course, that is an ambition, to not have any ambition. So it gets to be quite a trick to try to live without any ambitions, because that in itself is an ambition. Okay? Denying desire, eliminating suffering from the world is an ambition. So you try to deny desire, and what happens is you have to deny yourself as a personality and basically become impersonal in order to try to eliminate suffering in the world. Consequently, it starts a little bit off by saying that suffering comes from desire and you need to deny desire. And it ends up a long ways off into the person has to become less than a human being in order to eliminate suffering in the world. They have to become impersonal. Okay? And so it ends up a long ways off because it starts a little bit off. And so he proposed the Four Noble Truths, which talk about suffering coming from desire and how do you get rid of suffering by denying desire? How do you get rid of desire? And the way that you get rid of desire is by following the Eightfold Path, which is the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. The Eightfold Path, which involves right thought, right action, right vocation, right speech, that kind of thing. There's eight things that you're supposed to do that are right. Very close to the idea of the Ten Commandments, actually. So the Four Noble Truths, the fourth of which is the Eightfold Path, is the answer that Buddhism gives, but it's insufficient because it doesn't deal with the real problem, which is selfishness. It tries to deal with the with the capacities of man rather than the misuse of those capacities. Okay, the third insufficient answer is the answer of Hinduism. Sorry about my throat, but it's just sort of disappearing as the week goes along. My voice. Okay. Hinduism tries to answer the question two ways. Now, normally, you see, by this time I would have taught on Eastern religions, and this would be very easy for you to catch, but I'm going to have to do a little bit of explaining. Hinduism tries to answer the question two ways, the first of which is maya, which means illusion. Everything is an illusion. And the second one is karma, which is sort of a moral cause and effect. Moral cause and effect. Okay? Maya, the idea that everything is an illusion, is one answer that the person in Hinduism tries to give, is that suffering is an illusion, the world is an illusion, everything is an illusion, so it doesn't really make any difference whether or not innocent people suffer, because if guilty people suffer, if innocent people suffer, the suffering is all an illusion anyway. So the world doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Now, that is very difficult to tell to someone who has just fallen down on a ski slope and broken their leg, and you come along and find them with their leg broken, try to tell them that the world is an illusion, nothing makes any sense anyway, because it's all an illusion, you know, and they say, just bring your little illusory nose down next to my illusory fist, and I will give you an illusory message. And then you can go get me an illusory doctor, thank you. Okay? A little bit of reality there, or a whole lot of reality, will snap people back at times. Maya, the idea that everything is an illusion, is an insufficient answer. No one ever lives that way. Nice idea to toy around with, but no one ever lives like that. Okay? And then karma, the idea of moral cause and effect, says that whatever you give out into the universe by the choices that you make and the vibrations that you give off, as they say sometimes, whatever you give out into the system of the universe and God and whatever else is out there, impersonal God in this case, whatever you give out into that force, it will give back to you. And the things that you are suffering now are happening because of what you have given out in the past, in a past life or in the past of this present life. Okay? So whatever you give out, you get back. And so that answers the question by saying there are no innocent people. You understand? Only the guilty suffer then. Because whatever you're suffering now, even if you appear to be innocent now, it's happening to you maybe because of some crime you committed in a past life, according to reincarnation. And so the answer is given, basically, that there are no innocent parties. Everybody is receiving exactly what they get, or what they deserve, because of what they've given out. Another problem with this is it encourages more suffering because it's fatalistic. It encourages more suffering because it's fatalistic. If a person is receiving exactly what they deserve, why should you try to get them out of it? Okay? And that's why in India, people don't try to get other people. Indians don't, in many cases. If they're consistent, don't try to get other people out of their suffering. Okay? Because they believe that if they try to get out of their suffering, then they'll end up worse later because they're not accepting the punishment for what they've done in the past. And also, karma is inconsistent with maya. Now, what difference does it make if everything is an illusion, whether you're receiving good karma or bad karma? You're supposed to try to work to produce good karma for the next life. Okay? But what difference does that make if everything is an illusion anyway? What's the difference between good karma and bad karma if they're both an illusion? A fourth insufficient answer is nihilism. Nihilism, N-I-H-I-L-I-S-M, nihilism. Everything is meaningless, or everything is absurd. Again, try to tell that to someone who's just fallen down the stairs and broken their wrist. Okay? Well, this is meaningless, you know, life is just plain meaningless, nothing means anything. Everything is meaningless, so you may as well just go through the suffering, because that doesn't mean anything. Pleasure doesn't mean anything. Pain doesn't mean anything. Your existence doesn't mean anything. Everything is absurd. And of course, without God in the universe, everything would be absurd. So when people reject the idea of God, it's normal for them to come up with that idea. Number five is suicide. Believe it or not, some people propose the idea that if if you are simply an animal, and when you die, there's nothing that goes on living after that. You just go back to minerals when you die. That you may as well, if you're suffering now, you may as well die, because then you'd be better off dead. See? And so that people try to give that kind of an answer. People try to support that kind of. They try to support euthanasia sometimes. Sometimes on the basis of, you know, euthanasia, mercy killing. They try to support that idea on humanist grounds. The idea that man does not go on afterwards, and so it's better for the person not to exist than to exist in all the pain and suffering that they're going through right now. Well, the point is, you don't know whether or not. The humanist cannot tell whether or not the person will be better off dead. By what standard will you judge it? See? How many people have you talked to that have been dead and come back to tell you whether or not you'll be better off dead? Because they are presupposing that the person will be better off dead simply because they think that the person does not go on living afterwards, and so they'd be better off dead. Well, they have no guarantee that that is true. They have no evidence empirically that that is true. There may even be evidence to the contrary, that people actually do go on living. Okay? Then the enemy is very sly in that and tries to make people think that there is no judgment and there is no hell. So, how do you know you'll be better off dead? By what standard will you judge it? And a sixth answer that people try to give is mysticism. They try to be mystical with suffering. Try to be very mystical with suffering. They pretend that suffering somehow has some kind of intrinsic value. That there is something intrinsically good about suffering. Now, I know that's going to bring questions into your mind. We're going to talk about it. And a lot of Christians are caught right at this point. A lot of Christians teach this kind of thing. Almost every book on suffering that you will pick up from the Christian bookshelves today will present in their philosophy, when they talk about why do people suffer, they will present the idea that suffering somehow has some kind of intrinsic value. Okay? And I don't have very many books on suffering, and the reason I don't is because I pick them up, I look through the index, find the part that talks about the philosophy, I read their philosophy, and if it's just going to accuse God of something, I just put it down, put it back on the shelf. I don't need that kind of book. Okay? Now, it might be good for me to get some of those sometime, just for examples or whatever, but I haven't gotten very many because almost every book on the Christian bookshelf eventually, very subtly, ends up accusing God for what's going on in the world. You read them very carefully and think about them very deeply, and you will see that they are doing that. So what do I mean by mysticism? Well, people pretend that somehow, if you suffer, it is good for you. That the suffering, now listen, that the suffering in itself is good for you. I'm not saying here that people don't learn good things from suffering, but they don't learn the things from the suffering. They learn the things from God in the midst of their suffering. You get the difference? A broken leg does not teach you wonderful things about God. It's whether or not you submit to God when you have a broken leg that teaches you wonderful things about God. God teaches you things about Himself in the midst of suffering. The suffering itself does not teach you something about God, because God never intended that suffering should ever exist. Okay? Try to be a little more consistent here. I'm preaching instead of teaching, and I've got to go back to teaching. It's my little soapbox here. It angers me, in a sense, because, and I get on my soapbox, because I believe people are calling God unjust. They don't know that they're doing it. They're trying to give they're well-meaning, trying to give a good answer to why did innocent suffer. But they end up accusing God because they haven't really thought it through. And they quote off glib things about, you won't hear too many people teach the kind of stuff I'm going to teach this morning. Because I'm not satisfied with what most people teach. Okay? So, many Christians are caught right here. And the reason they're caught is because they do not keep suffering, listen, suffering, and God's redemptive actions in the midst of suffering separate. There's a big difference between those two. Suffering is one thing. God's redemptive actions in the midst of suffering is a completely different thing. That's something that He does, not something that the suffering does. Do you understand? God, if you submit to God, even though you're suffering as an innocent person, if you submit to God, God can teach you wonderful things And he can use that bad circumstance, if you submit to him, to teach you some wonderful things. But that does not mean, therefore, that the bad circumstance was arranged by him. You see, it doesn't logically follow. It's like this. It's a matter of perspective. For a long time, people would look at the sun, and the sun appears to come up, right? And so they thought, the earth is standing still, and the sun is moving. But that's not true. The sun is standing still, and the earth is moving. The earth's going like this. Okay, so people thought that the sun came up. That was a problem of perspective. See? Not having a large enough perspective on what was happening. It was a limited perspective. And what happens with people in suffering is they think like this. I fell down and broke my leg. While I had a broken leg, I learned some wonderful things about patience, about understanding other people's pain, about courage, about my lack of devotional life and prayer life. I was drawn closer to God. I learned wonderful things while I had the broken leg. Therefore, God must have wanted me to break my leg. Doesn't logically follow, you see? What they're doing is confusing God's redemptive actions in the midst of suffering and suffering. They're confusing those two. You understand? Now, the Bible says concerning us, shall we do evil that good may come? It says if we do evil that good may come, our damnation is just. We deserve to be damned, condemned, if we do evil in order that good may come. And yet people accuse God of the same thing. See? Accuse him of doing evil in order that good may come. I'm not answering any questions, thank you. Okay? Oh, evil, doing evil in order that good may come? Romans 3, first few verses. Okay? Because that's what people were accusing Paul the Apostle of teaching that we should do evil that good may come. And God says that we're not supposed to do it, so we expect that he's going to do things like that? Does God, another question, does God need something like suffering in order to teach us his lessons? If we say he needs suffering in order to teach us his lessons, then he created Adam and Eve in a deficient fashion. He created them and intended for them not to have suffering and pain. He never wanted this to come into the world, and there are explicit statements in the Bible that say he doesn't like it. Right? Even the life of Jesus shows that. Why would he go around healing people if suffering was good for them? Okay? Yet he went around healing them all the time. Okay? Because he loves them and he doesn't like suffering. It says Jesus snorted in spirit when he was faced with the death of Lazarus. Okay? The Greek word means like a horse rearing up ready to charge into battle. He snorted in spirit. He was upset at death because it was an intruder in his father's world. It wasn't ever supposed to be there. God says, do I have any pleasure? Ezekiel 18. Do I have any pleasure in the death of the wicked? Wouldn't I rather that he repent and live? God doesn't have any pleasure in that. Okay, so God doesn't want death. He says, choose life. Why would you want to die? Doesn't want anything like that. So I'm going to go back to teaching now. Many Christians are caught right here because they don't keep suffering and God's redemptive actions in the midst of suffering separate. Because God has moved in the midst of suffering to teach you something while you're suffering does not mean that therefore he wanted you to suffer or that that was the will of God for you. As a matter of fact, as I said, there are explicit statements that God never wanted anything like what's going on in the world now. Does God want war? No, he says it comes from our selfishness. Where does war come from? James says in James 3, beginning of James 4, that's right, thank you. Beginning of James 4, it says where do wars and strivings come from? They come from your selfishness, which is waging war in your members. That's where it comes from. It comes from God. God never wanted war. Doesn't like it. Now, some people will then try to appeal to the Christian fatalist verse, which is Romans 8:28, and they appeal to it. They always have to do this in the King James version because you can't get it out of anything else, out of any good version. In the King James version, it says that, and we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. Now, even in the King James, it's conditional. It's if you love God and are called according to His purpose. It does not guarantee that for the unbeliever, all things work together for good, does it? It's conditional. But then, when you read it in the Greek, the verb does not say that the things work. It says that God is at work. It says, God is at work in the midst of all things for the good of those who love Him and are called according to His purpose. We may go through suffering And the suffering is not coming from God, but God is big enough, smart enough, wise enough, loving enough, that no matter what happens to us, He can work something good out of it. If we love Him, that is submitting to Him, and if we're called according to His purpose. If we belong to Him and we love Him, no matter what happens to us, if we turn it over to God, God can make something good out of it. See? He can do something good with it, I should say. He can teach us some good things. Not necessarily going to make it a good situation. See? Because sometimes the reason we suffer is because, as innocent people, is because of the sin of other people. And did God want them to sin? No. It's express will that God doesn't want people to sin. There's a woman that's paralyzed from the waist down because a couple of days ago, she got robbed by a person on the street and the guy shot her, and now she's paralyzed from the waist down. Did God want that person to shoot her? Did God want the person to steal? No, it's against His express will in the Bible. Thou shalt not steal. Okay? Probably was trying to kill her when he shot her. And it's also against His express will, thou shalt not kill, shall not murder. Okay? And so did God want that to happen? No. Okay? But if that person is a Christian and she submits to God in the midst of that situation, God can teach her. He can use that situation that is not part of His will, that was never intended to exist. He can use that situation to teach her something. Are you beginning to get the idea? The big difference there is between suffering that takes place that may happen because of sin. And we'll talk about eight areas of suffering that need to be kept separate later, but suffering that happens because of sin or something that God does not want, and yet God can use that for good. You understand? But it only works good, listen, it only works good if you love Him and are called according to His purpose. Two people can become sick with the same thing and be laid up in a hospital, one of them a Christian, and they can submit to God, and God can work wonderful things in their life through that sickness. The unbeliever can take the wrong attitude, become bitter towards God, and become worse and worse and worse and die and go to hell. Suffering in itself does not guarantee that something good will come out of it. It is God who guarantees for the Christian that something good will come out if they love Him and submit to Him in the midst of the suffering. And have the right heart attitude. You get the difference? Suffering in itself does not guarantee that something good will come out of it. It depends on how you respond in the midst of suffering. Your response to God determines whether or not something good will be worked out. See, Job made the right response, and something good was worked out of his suffering. But was it the will of God that his children should be killed and he should lose his property? Was that the will of God? That his wife should say to him, "Why don't you curse God and die?" Was that the will of God? No. But he made the right response in all of that, and God was able to work some good things out in his life. Okay, now there are actually some theologies that teach, and some theologians who teach, that suffering and sin and pain and disease and death and war and all the bad things that are happening in the world are really part of the will of God. They actually teach that kind of thing. And of course, that's an awful slam on the justice of God. And it's, of course, against the scripture. They teach that God actually arranges for children to be born deformed. That God is the one who once wanted all evil to come into existence. You see? That kind of thing. And you will hear it in very subtle ways sometimes that sound very nice. Things like this. Well, if we hadn't fallen into sin, then God would have never been able to express His love to us through giving His Son for us in the Lord Jesus. If we had never fallen into sin, we wouldn't have needed it. Would we? You see? And we would have lived in perfect, unbroken fellowship with God and His Son without needing to be redeemed. God wouldn't have had to go through the awful agony of having people reject Him, being grieved, having to eliminate everybody but eight people at one time. He wanted to kill everybody. He wanted to eliminate everybody. In His love, it was loving because of the wickedness of man. But He thought it was best to eliminate everybody. And if it hadn't been for Noah's righteousness and faith, we wouldn't be here. Because God said, "I will kill man, period, man that I have made." But, an interesting but, and a very important one, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. He was a preacher of righteousness. Boy, good thing. Thank you, Noah. See? Have to say thank you to him when we get there, won't we? Thank you. Yeah. Okay, because there wouldn't have been anything left. Maybe God would have started over again and tried again. I don't know. But there are some theologians who actually teach that God is the author of suffering. See? And they may teach it in very subtle ways, and we need to think What is this saying about God? We need to really think about it. What are they saying about God and about His world? somehow they think it is His will that suffering actually exists. And yet all the way through the Bible, He says that it is not His will that people die and suffer. It's His will that we would prosper and be well. Okay? The reason we don't is because of sin. And because of other, not necessarily our sin. It could be because of other people's sin. And we can be innocent people suffering. And so they say, we must not question God's will. We have to accept it. And so if we are suffering, that's part of the will of God for us. God knows everything. God has everything all planned out. And so if you are suffering, if you've got a broken leg, it's part of God's will for you, and God may teach you wonderful things out of it, but that's just part of God's will, and you need to accept it. You know what I find really interesting? That some of these same churches that teach this send out medical missionaries. Now, what are they doing running around the world trying to get people out of the will of God for them? You see? It's inconsistent. I'm glad they're inconsistent. You see? Because what they're doing is obeying the Bible, and they're inconsistent in their philosophy. So I'm glad they're obeying the Bible and going and helping people who are sick. But they're inconsistent with their philosophy, because their philosophy says it's the will of God for the person, and so they're there trying to help them get out of the will of God for them. But I'm glad they're inconsistent, as I say. Now, there was a YWAMer. You say, people really teach this kind of stuff? Mm-hmm. Very blatantly. There was a YWAMer sitting in a church one time, and his pastor stood up and said, leaned over the podium and said, now, if I were to tell you that God is the author of all pain and all disease and suffering, that God plans that every child that's born deformed is deformed, and that God wants wars to exist, and He is the one who makes wars happen, he said, you would find that really hard to believe, wouldn't you? And the YWAMer was sitting there going, yes, I'd find it hard to believe, and it's not true either. And then he leaned over the podium a little farther, and he said, you may find that hard to believe, but that's the way it is. And then he went on to preach, saying, every baby that's born deformed, God wanted them to be deformed. Every person who's killed in a car accident, God wanted them, or paralyzed from the neck down, that's what God wanted. That's all, because it comes from the teaching that the will of God is always done on the earth. That God's will is consistently and always being done. Is that biblical? No. Why would Jesus ask us to pray that the will of God will be done on earth if it was always being done? He taught us to pray, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We're supposed to pray for it. It isn't happening. What is the will of God for us? That we abstain from fornication. This is the will of God, even your sanctification, 1 Thessalonians 4, that you abstain from fornication. Do Christians ever commit fornication? Yes. See, the will of God is not always being done, because if Christians commit fornication, they're doing something that the Bible says is expressly against the will of God. See, this is the will of God, that you should not commit fornication. You know any other statements that say, this is the will of God? In everything, give thanks. Have you always given thanks in every circumstance in your Christian life? No. Then the will of God was not done in your life in that circumstance. See? Expressly says the will of God. See? Okay, so there are some people who actually teach that suffering is somehow the will of God. I've heard songs, Christian songs. I wrote a letter to a Christian group one time because they had a song that said that if all you ever have is sunshine, I don't want to quote their words, if all you ever have is sunshine, then you're never really going to grow. You have to have rain in order to grow. And what the parallel they were making was, if everything goes well in your life, you're never going to grow. You have to have some kind of difficulty and suffering in order to grow. Well, may I ask then exactly how Adam and Eve were supposed to grow if they had sunshine all the time? And what about heaven? God is determined that we're not going to grow, because He's going to remove all suffering and all pain and all sin and all disease. He's going to make a perfect environment. There will be no unrighteousness, the Bible says. There will be a new earth wherein dwells righteousness. And if that's not good for us, God is purposing our ill-being. We need to think about these things. Okay? You'll hear things like that people say, and you got to go, that's not right. What about heaven? Heaven's not going to be good for us then, because God's going to eliminate all that. God never intended that we should suffer. We know that intuitively. We can read it in the Bible, but somehow we've been duped, many of us, to believe that somehow suffering has some intrinsic value. We become very mystical with suffering. Okay? Now remember, I'm not saying that suffering, that God can't use suffering. If I suffer as an innocent person, God can use that. And sometimes God will use suffering to try to get my attention when I'm a guilty person. Right? Only that we do not call the innocent suffering, we call that judgment. And then you deserve to receive it. I have suffered because of the judgment of God. I was sick, what was it, 2 weeks ago? I was sick, and I got healed because I repented. I said, God, has this come upon? I wanted to know if I'd done anything wrong. I said, has this come because of anything I've done? He gave me a verse, and it went, you know, pointed out a bunch of sins, and I went, right, God. And so I repented, had the elders pray for me, and I was healed right then. See? Now, there are times when, as a judgment, that kind of thing comes upon us. And so God gets our attention. But then I wasn't an innocent person suffering. I was a guilty person suffering, see, because of my sin. I don't have any problems with that in the justice of God. See? It's when the innocent suffer that it becomes a big problem. Okay. How much time do we have left in this? Oh, okay. We'll keep going then. I'll get through the next section, then we'll take a break. We want to look for a little while at the Christian background. We're going to start looking at the Christian answer now, but we want to look at the background of why the innocent can suffer even though there is a God who is a God of love. And it's important to know the background of how God created the world, what the world is like, how it functions, who God is, see, that kind of stuff. It's important to know that in order to answer the question. Okay? So we'll look at the background to this, which has to do with what reality is like. God created man in his own image. Okay? Now you can take the right-hand side here and put it back over on the left-hand side. I'm not going to repeat it. I'm just going to put an arrow. God created man in his image. If God was going to create man in his image, then this had to be. If that was, then this had to be. Okay? You see how that's working? Okay? Just taking a progression, a step down. Okay? God made man in his own image. In order to make man in his own image, like himself, he had to give man certain capacities. And one of those was he had to be self-aware. Or he had to have self-consciousness. Not self-consciousness in the way that we think of I'm self-conscious because somebody's looking at me. He had to have self-consciousness or self-awareness in order to be a moral being. If you were not self-aware, then you would have no awareness of emotions, intellect, or will. And so you couldn't be a moral being if you were not self-aware. Understand? Rocks are not self-aware. That's why they're not moral beings. Animals, I believe, are also not self-aware in the sense that we are self-aware. I believe they're aware of their environment, but I don't think that they relate to themselves as an I. They respond to their environment, but I don't think they have any response to an I. Otherwise, you'd see dogs worrying about the future. You see? Do they ever worry about the future? No, they just respond to the present stimulus. Because there's no real conception of I, is there, Ginger? No response. Okay? No, not even a response to the environment when she's asleep. Okay. So if he's going to make man in his own image, then man has to be self-conscious. Or self-aware. Now, you have to have self-awareness for free will to exist. I'll give you a few other points in here that aren't part of the chart. You have to have self-awareness in order for free will to exist. So if man was going to be like God, he had to be like God in being self-aware so that he could be a moral being. You also have to have alternative choice to have freedom. Alternative choice is necessary for freedom. If man was made with a will, but could only choose to do one thing or a particular set of things, it would not be a free will, so there would be no freedom. Okay? If man can only choose to do one kind of thing, then free will does not exist. And he would not be the kind of being that God wanted him to be. For instance, some theologies teach that man is born in such a way that all he can do is evil. He cannot do what is good. See, Calvin himself said in his Institute, man cannot do good and he cannot even aspire to do good. See? Now, I don't believe that fits with the scriptural revelation of man, what man is, because God judges us for not doing what is right. Read Romans 1. Even from natural revelation without specific revelation, God judges us and says that we are guilty of not serving Him and deserve to be punished because we should have known from creation who He was and we should have served Him. Okay? Now, He's not talking about people who have specific revelation or people who are Christians. He's talking about unbelieving people who don't have specific revelation. And He says they are guilty because they didn't choose to do what was right. They didn't give thanks or glorify God or serve Him. Okay? Now, why, if God judges that person and sends them to hell, it's not fair if they couldn't choose to do anything but evil. Okay? If man can only choose to do one thing, and that is evil, then it's not fair for God to judge him, because he's not free. The reason God is fair in judging us is because we could have chosen to do something else. We didn't have to steal. We didn't have to lie. We didn't have to disobey our parents. And yet we did. Okay? And that's why God was just in condemning us. Okay? But now that we're forgiven, hallelujah, that won't come upon us. Okay, so if man is self-aware and free will exists and there is alternative choice, then logically following, you need a couple more steps in there and you can work it out yourself. Logically following, man is therefore responsible. Man has to be responsible then because he has to choose to do this or that, and he will understand that he should choose to do this and not that. Got that? Man will understand that he should choose to do this and not that. Therefore, he is responsible. That is the basic idea of moral obligation. I should choose to do this and not that. Basically, I should choose to do what is loving and not selfish. Okay, so if man is going to be self-aware, you can put that over here again. Man is going to be self-aware. He had to come into a particular kind of environment. He had to come into a particular kind of environment. Okay? That is, there had to be an objective reality. There had to be an objective reality. If he was going to be self-aware, he had to have something with which to compare himself. Now you may ask, if you're really thinking quickly here, what about God being a self-aware being before he created anything when there was only God? Right? Well, that is solved by the fact that is solved when you understand that God has a particular kind of nature, and that is what? Infinite doesn't solve the problem. I heard it. That God is three and God is one. And so there is an objectivity and a subjectivity within the being of God from all eternity just because of his very nature. You see? When two of the beings in the being of God love each other, the third being can say, objectively, this is correct. This is right. You see? And so there is objectivity and subjectivity within the being of God. And so God did have, in essence, an objective environment within his own nature. And so self-awareness makes sense because an objective environment still existed even though God himself was the only being who existed. Got that? See? And so when God made us as individual single beings, we had to have something else apart from us that was part of the unity and diversity, see, like him, in order to have an objective environment so we could be self-aware. Okay? Let us go on. Okay, so there has to be an objective reality. There has to be an environment. Okay, and if there is going to be an environment in which man is self-aware and in which man is free to express his choices, it has to be a stable environment. That is, there has to be the rule of law and not miracle. In order for man to be free, to be able to express his will and to have self-awareness that he could use in expressing his will, man had to be brought into an environment that was stable. That is, it isn't constantly changing, so that the rules are according to law that we can depend upon, okay, with our minds, the rule according to law and not according to miracle. If everything changed all the time according to the whim of every subjective whim of every human being, it would be difficult for us to express our will, right? What if you wanted to sit down on a chair and somebody with their mind could change that into a rattlesnake. You've got a problem, you see. What if you wanted to take a pie, a lemon meringue pie, to someone? Sounds nice, isn't it? What if you wanted to take a lemon meringue pie to someone, and someone else, with their mind, could change it into arsenic? No? What about that? What if they could change the egg yolks in it to arsenic by just a thought? If the then you would be limited in what you could do, because of when you try to make a choice, it could suddenly turn out differently than you thought it was going to turn out. And so man, in order to express freedom and having a free will, must have a stable environment that he can depend upon, where the rule is law and the exception is miracle, right? Rather than the other way around. It's okay to have miracle, but the rule has to be law rather than miracle for man to be able to express his free will. Now, let me get off into a little practical sideline here, and that is, in the event of punishment and consequences, you have to be careful to keep punishment and consequences for sin separate when you're talking with people. Because when a person is forgiven, the punishment can always be taken away, because the punishment is separation from God. And God says they can be forgiven and fellowship can be restored, they can be reconciled with God on the basis of what Jesus has done on the cross if the person repents, right? Punishment can always be taken away. Consequences cannot always be taken away. Because consequences does not always have to do with just morality. Sometimes it has to do with the laws of the physical universe. And God is not free to always go around breaking the laws of the physical universe that he established for our good. Do you understand that? I will give you a very blatant example. And I'm sure you've heard this before, but it's because you can very clearly see that another law is involved besides the laws of free will. Let's say a girl goes out, a Christian girl, goes out and becomes pregnant. She's not married, right? She gets pregnant because she commits fornication. If the girl repents, she can be forgiven by God, and she will not have to suffer punishment from God because she's been forgiven, right? She repents, God forgives her, there will be no punishment. But can God make the baby go away? No, because there now exists another moral being that God is completely committed to, you see? He's completely committed to that new moral being just as much as he is to the mother. And so he must be just, he must be fair to that new moral being that exists, and he can't just simply make it go away. He can't do that. See? What he can do out of the situation is, because as we spoke about before, now that the woman is going to have a baby, if she submits to him, he can make something good out of that. See? It's not as if she has to suffer under that thing in the sense of suffering. God can take that and make it a good learning experience for her, even though the child was never supposed to exist. Now, that may shock some of you, but that's my personal opinion, is that because of fornication, I believe that some people exist that were not supposed to exist. But I have to balance that out with other statements, you see. And people go, you mean, because there may be some people here who were born from fornication, and I do not mean that you don't have any significance. You have just as much significance as anybody else. I do not mean that God is in some way against you. He's not against anybody. You understand what I mean? But that because what happened with your parents, if there's anybody here like that, because of what happened with your parents, you, if it was in fornication or out of wedlock, you were not intended by God to exist. But now that you do exist, he's completely committed to you just as much as anybody else. There's no difference between the person who was born out of wedlock as far as God is concerned and any other person who is born. You understand that? But the person was not intended to exist. Now, when you think about that, you can see why we have a population crisis. If people were not committing fornication or adultery and things like that, there would be a lot fewer people in the world. See? It'd be a lot fewer problems. You understand what I mean? And so people sometimes get the idea when I say that. Fornication is the misuse of a capacity God has given us to control. Fornication is the misuse of a capacity God has given us to control. And that person that is born out of fornication, not their fault, their parents' fault. There's no fault implied on the part of the child. at all. You see, it's the parent's fault. It wasn't the child's fault at all. There's no sin involved there. But then when that person comes into existence, then God completely commits himself in love, in justice, and I believe at that point may even have a purpose planned for that person. Now, I'm not saying he always does, because I don't believe that either. You understand what I mean? No, you don't understand what I mean. Blank faces. Okay? Blank faces. I do not go along with the teaching, and you can think about it. I mean, you may have that kind of idea, and I don't say you shouldn't have it, but you need to think about it. I do not go along with the teaching that because God spoke in the Bible that there were certain people that he called from their mother's womb, that therefore God has called everybody to a specific purpose from their mother's womb. That is bad Bible. That's bad exegesis. It's bad interpretation. To say that because of a couple of specific cases in the Bible, God says to a person, I called you from your mother's womb and ordained you to a particular purpose, that therefore everybody in the world has been called to a particular purpose by God from their mother's womb, don't believe is necessarily true. You see? Because then you know what you have to say? You know what that implies? Follow it through. That if a person is born out of wedlock, born in fornication, and that person, God has a particular purpose for that person from their mother's womb, say from conception, then God planned for someone to commit fornication. And yet God says that's explicitly against his will. You understand? Get that? And so what some people are trying to do is they're trying to say, you are significant to the person who's been born out of wedlock. But you don't have to say that. You don't have to say that God had some kind of a plan for you or that you were intended to exist. You don't have to say that. You are significant because you're in the image of God. No matter how you came about, you have just as much significance as anybody else. And God is committed to you just as much as anybody else. See? Makes no difference. God is not partial, the Bible says. He's no respecter of persons. Doesn't matter how you were born. Okay? So I want you to understand that there are certain principles that sometimes people say, God intends that every person that exists existed. You see? If you exist, it was God's will for you to come into existence. You mean it was God's will for my parents to commit fornication? Because that's how it happened. See? You don't have to say that to say God loves you, you're just as significant as everybody else, and God can use you just as much as anybody else and wants to use you. See? That's true about the person no matter how they came about. Yes? No? Okay. Because sometimes people are trying to communicate those ideas and they say false things about God and his will at the same time that they're trying to say positive things to the person. And you don't need it. You don't need to say anything strange about God to say something good about the person. Okay. If you have personal questions about that because of your own life, then you can ask me about it later and we can talk more about it if it hasn't completely satisfied you. Okay, so there needs to be the rule of law and not miracle. Oh yes, we were talking about God can always take away the punishment. He can't always take away the consequences because there may be other principles that are involved that he cannot violate justly. Now the key word there is justly. Can God make a person disappear? Sure, he's got the power. But can he justly do it? No. Because he now has a being who is going to live forever that is in his image, and he must allow them to receive the consequences of their choices. He can't justly eliminate them. That's why the annihilation of the wicked is such a silly doctrine. The annihilation of the wicked, if God could take the wicked and simply annihilate them rather than have them go on in hell for eternity, that means all the choices that they made while they were alive on earth had no significance. Because they're not receiving the consequences of the choices that they made. You see? So if the annihilation of the wicked says that man has no significance, that's what it implies. You understand? Got that? That's why it's such a silly doctrine. If man is really significant, he must go on forever, either in heaven or in hell, receiving the consequences of his choices. Otherwise, his choices are not significant. Okay? I need to rush on here in the next couple of minutes. What we got? Okay. I don't know if I'll use it all, but... Okay, so if the rule is law rather than miracle, see, it has to be that way in order for freedom to exist. If the rule is law rather than miracle, then it's going to be a stable environment. Stable environment. If there is a stable environment, it will not always be agreeable to everyone. Okay? not always agreeable to everyone. Now, my wife and I have a problem with this. And you've probably heard about this before. Am I still okay? Can I move that? You've probably heard about this problem before, between my wife and I. Not real serious, but we do have problems. If it is exactly the right temperature in the room for my wife, it is too warm for me. If it is just right for me, it is usually too cold for my wife. Now, funny thing about that, the air does not sort of change its temperature around me to suit me and change its temperature around Carol to suit Carol. It doesn't do that. God has created a stable environment, and we have to deal with the laws as they are. They don't change themselves for our benefit. See? So when the room is just the right temperature for Carol, it's usually not agreeable to me. It's usually too warm. And that's a problem that we have with the environment. But God cannot go around changing that all the time. It's not subject to miracle. It's ruled by principles that we call laws. Okay? The laws that God has established for the order in the universe so that man can have freedom, so that man can express his self-awareness. And so if one person is going downhill, a person going in the opposite direction must be going uphill. The hill will not change for the person. The thing is, both people may enjoy what they're doing. The one person may be out for a walk. They want to go uphill because they want to take a good hike that day. The other person may be going home from work and be glad that it's downhill. You see? And so it can be that both people like it, but still, one has to go downhill and the other has to go uphill if they're going in different directions. The hill does not change for the purpose of the person. Now, if I had a piece of metal, let's say this is a piece of metal, piece of steel, and I have to get over here because I can't reach anybody. If I had a piece of metal, a piece of steel, well, let's make it a piece of wood because it's easier to see the illustration. Piece of wood here, nice heavy piece of wood, and I wanted to hit Tom over the head with it. Okay? I don't want to do that, Tom. But if I wanted to hit Tom over the head with this piece of wood, there is no guarantee that this wood will change into a feather before I hit him in order to protect Tom. Because of the way that God has established the laws for our good, he is not free to constantly be changing the laws of the universe, which he established for our good, in order to protect innocent people. He's not free to do that. Okay, now, is God responsible for the lump on Tom's head? No, I am. Okay? It's not God's fault, and it's not God's fault because he doesn't go around changing the laws all the time. He doesn't need to go around changing the laws all the time. It's our fault that these things exist, not his. He didn't make a mistake when he made the world the way he did. It's when people sin that it brings suffering upon the innocent. Okay? It's not God's fault, and it's not because God made the world the wrong way. It's good for us this way, that it stays that way. Now, I can take the same piece of wood, and if we were cold, and I can build a fire and keep us warm. See? And so how the environment is used depends upon our choice. I can hurt somebody with a piece of wood, or I can help somebody with a piece of wood. It depends on my choice. And yet the environment doesn't necessarily change all the time to suit people or to keep suffering from happening. That would not be good for us. Because what would happen if God changed the environment all the time? He would take away our freedom and make us less than beings in his image. And so by changing the environment all the time, he would be doing us a worse thing. He would be doing something worse to us than trying to take away temporary suffering. You understand? He'd be making us something less than human beings, taking away our freedom if he constantly changed the environment. You're beginning to sink in? And so he will not do that, because it would be worse for us. Let's take a break.